So changing and adapting my story to touch the hearts of these people or to touch their pockets in other ways is such a, it's such a very, very interesting part of my job, and I love it. And I love to create, I love to write, and I love to speak, and I love to network.
ZukunftsmacherInnen, der Alumni-Podcast der TU Berlin. Hallo, schön, dass ihr dabei seid. Willkommen bei den ZukunftsmacherInnen. Ich bin Regine Marxen, Journalistin, Podcasterin und Host dieser Reihe. Und gerade habt ihr Flora Ikawa-Witte gehört, unsere Zukunftsmacherin in dieser Folge. Aber bevor ich mit ihr unter anderem über die Kunst des Storytellings und des Netzwerks spreche, möchte ich euch kurz diesen Podcast vorstellen für alle, die uns vielleicht zum ersten Mal hören. Zukunftsmacherinnen ist der Alumni-Podcast der Technischen Universität Berlin. Der Name verrät es schon, hier geht es um die Zukunft, genauer um die, die sie machen, um die Alumni der TU Berlin. In jeder Folge stellen wir euch einen oder eine von ihnen vor. Wir schöpfen aus dem Vollen. 35.000 Mitglieder hat das Alumni-Netzwerk aus 139 Ländern. Menschen mit den unterschiedlichsten Talenten, Ideen und kulturellen Backgrounds, die sich bis heute mit der TU Berlin verbunden fühlen. Sie alle eint der Wille, die Welt ein Stück besser machen zu wollen. Ich frage Sie, wie Sie dorthin gekommen sind, wo Sie heute stehen. Wie haben Sie Ihr Studium erlebt? Lief immer alles geradlinig oder gab es auch Momente des Zweifelns? Wie sind Sie damit umgegangen? Und jetzt, wo Sie mittendrin sind im Berufsleben, was ist Ihre Vision? Womit beschäftigen Sie sich heute, um das Morgen zu gestalten? Flora Ikawa-Witte kommt aus Kenia. Heute lebt sie in Berlin und ist Director Germany bei African Parks Network. 2005 bis 2007 hat sie an der TU Berlin Urban Management studiert. Wie sie danach in das Fundraising-Business gekommen ist, das frage ich Sie später. Bevor wir starten, ein Hinweis. Das Interview haben wir in englischer Sprache geführt. Okay, starten wir. Flora, you associate the number 40 with a specific goal, don't you?
Yes, I do. I do. And the goal is the goal we're having. We're having a vision in African Parks to manage 40 parks by 2030. That is an increase of 18 parks from what we currently have. So we currently manage 22 national parks and protected areas in 12 countries, covering about 20 million hectares. And we want to go to 40 million hectares by 2030.
You are often on the ground in Africa, but your job is actually based in Germany, isn't it? So what exactly is your job at African Parks Network?
I'm a fundraiser, so I am the director of the foundation of the German Foundation of African Parks. So what African Parks has done, because there's a lot of investment and funding that is required within the work that we do, what we have done is to create foundations in key markets in Europe. So we have one in the Netherlands, we have one in Germany, we have one in the UK, we have one in Denmark, and I manage the one in Germany. And it is mainly to raise funds for the work that we do. We currently have a budget of about $100 million a year. And this is mainly from donations from people, but also from bilateral institutes and foundations and all. But a big chunk of it is from charity, from people who give to charity.
So how exactly does your job work in practical terms?
So you can imagine that, say, for instance, I give you an example. I want to engage somebody and take them through a prospect journey. So I reach out to a high net worth individual, either through the board. So I have a board of directors, and this board of directors is helping me to open doors to people who are prospective donors. So I want to walk a prospect journey with one person from the time when I get the contact to this person. So it's a lot about that appeal, telling our story, engaging this person over a period of time until in a time, say, in exactly 1 year or a year and a half, they're saying, I would love to donate 50, 100,000, 200,000 or less or more over a number of years to African parks because I can see what you're doing is very, very interesting. So apart from that, I have a strategy of engaging different levels and typologies of donors. So one typology is the ultra high net worth individual. Another typology is bilateral institutes. Another is foundations. But even within the ultra high net worth individuals, we also have subcategorization. So we have people who are leading their own companies or family companies, but also younger entrepreneurs or the venture capitalists. So these are younger people who are buying and selling companies. So they have a different approach to giving. So I create strategies and I follow up these strategies with the different typologies. At the end of it, my job is to raise funds. So I take them through the journey, which takes sometimes people with us for 5 years before they give. Sometimes they give us money in no time. So it is to tweak that prospect journey and also to take them to the park. So once somebody is given such an amount of money, they'd love to know or to see the impact within the park. So what we do is we showcase behind the scenes of what we do within the park. So we travel with them. They're able to join us for some of our key events. So for instance, we translocated, we moved 263 elephants from one park to another. And the whole translocation is very, very emotional, very exciting. And so we invite some of our key supporters to actually see and be a part of us and be a witness to that. So that's my job.
It's all about money.
Yes.
How long have you been doing this?
I've been working with African parks for a little over a year. However, I call myself a career fundraiser. I have been fundraising for the last 15 years of my life. So I know the ins and outs of all these typologies of donors, as I called them before. Yes.
What do you like about your job?
I like telling stories. So as I explained before, it really depends from one person to another, what can appeal to them. And one always has to change or to tweak the story to be able to reach to this person's heart. So a different one person might need it, you know, might need a more emotional touch to it. Another might just want the impact numbers. I want to see that, you know, by this time, if I put in this money, this is what's going to happen. Another might want to see, okay, but what are you doing globally? Another one may want to see, what are you doing at the community level? So changing and adapting my story to touch the hearts of these people or to touch their pockets in other ways is such a very, very interesting part of my job. And I love it. And I love to create, I love to write, and I love to speak, and I love to network and create that creating of that story. And also writing it down and measuring the impact and being able to communicate that impact is super exciting.
Is it a kind of challenge for you? I want your money and I get it?
The challenge is actually to start with somebody who is skeptical and to take them through that removal of that skepticism. And quite a number of people are shy about asking for money. But asking for money is never a direct way of asking for money. So I meet somebody, I say, well, I want 100,000 from you. No, that's not how we do it. What we do is we take them through a journey. It's a conversion journey, as we call it. So from the skeptical person to saying, hey, did you know that this is what has happened within the world in a different part of the world, but this is impacting you in your little corner in Baden-Württemberg just because we're globally connected. And so it increasingly making these threads in order to take away that challenge and in order to make this person listen more. So from the person who's not listening to the person who's listening very closely to the person who wants to see, that's how you tackle the problem.
Now we know what you like. Are there things you don't like?
Yes, of course. Every job comes with its perks and its downs. So what I, as I said, you know, I love being the creative person. I love being the person going out there. I love being the person shaking hands. And however, part of this job also means that there is a lot of paperwork to be done. There are a lot of receipts to be done. There are lots of funds to be transferred here and there. There are letters to be written of thank yous. There's a lot of what we call back office, putting out the stamps, sending out the reports. All this, it takes a lot of time, but it is part and parcel of the job. And this is, you know, one of the ones which we must do, but it's not the one that makes me wake up in the morning. Like, yes, I'm going to send out my stamps and my reports today, but it is part and parcel of it. Another part that which is not related specifically to the job itself, but it's a challenge to the sector I'm working in, to African Parks, is that there are so many NGOs working in silos. So little NGOs, they're all coming up, new organizations are coming up, sprouting up. And we are not working together. And it would be so lovely to have a collective effort of some sort to, you know, to work in partnership so that we can increase our impact in different ways, but, you know, to collate ourselves and not to think that we have to go solo with all these smaller ones. And so this unhealthy competition, which we could take away that challenge by working together in partnership, is something I don't like, you know, especially talking to my counterparts in these smaller organizations and telling them, well, the information you're giving to these people is wrong, or, you know, having to challenge my other counterparts. That I don't like.
What kind of talents do you need to be a good fundraiser?
One must be committed to a cause. Because if you ask someone to go and sell socks and this person lives in the desert and doesn't wear socks, that's just a very, very base, blasé example. Mm-hmm. But it has to be a passion coming from within, a passion for the cause, and also something that actually almost personally impacts that person. Conservation impacts us all. I love animals. I have a son who I go to the park with every year, and he loves to see this. And I want it to be there for him and for his children and his grandchildren and his great-great-grandchildren. And so the passion has to accompany it, because then it makes you a good storyteller in order to be able to fundraise for the cause. Another is high perseverance, because the prospect journey in some cases can take 5 years. So you have to persevere, keep engaging this person. Usually it takes about a year and a half from the time you get contact to someone to the time they put the money on the table. It's a year. Usually people think, I'll go meet this person and they'll give me the money in 2 weeks. No, that's not. It's a whole journey. And so you have to be persevere. You have to be determined and not lose that energy along the way in order to follow through this. One has to be creative, a creative thinker. So I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. When it comes to bilateral fundraising, you know, fundraising from the BMZ of our time or the USAID or UKAID, a lot of the funding is impacted by politics and the political, or who is in power at the time. So for instance, before some of these countries started, you know, voting more center-right and right, there was a lot of funding, say, for governance in these countries or for looking into other basic needs. But now, since they're more focused on trying to stop immigration, most of this funding is being channeled to projects which tackle migration. So the creativity is in how do I shape my, or how do I make the links between conservation and migration, if I'm working on conservation, or how do I make the links between health and migration, if I'm working on health, in order to be able to access this funding. So you change the way you tell your story. So it is addressing the areas that they have now created as their own priority areas. So that creativity and being adaptable to such changes is very key. And of course, the ability to motivate and I think it's very hard for an introvert to be a fundraiser, but you know, if you can speak, if you have great interpersonal skills, one is a good listener, they are on their way to be good fundraisers.
Let's look at how you got to where you are today. You completed your bachelor's of education, science, mathematics and geography in Kenya, and then came to Berlin in 2005 to do your master's in urban management at the TU Berlin. How did this change come about?
I love math. I love geography. And I married the two. But the only way I could do this was through education. And so I am a teacher. I am a math and geography teacher, and I taught for 2 years at a high school. But I am also somebody who requires constant input of new things and new challenges, and education wasn't giving me that. And so I tried to look around, so what can I do with my geography? But also, you know, math is always great for everything. But look, what can I do with my geography? And being in Nairobi and sitting in a traffic jam every day for 3 hours or 4 hours in total a day, I was thinking, why have we not planned our city better? Why have we not created a public transport system which actually is for the people? And these questions led me to look into deeper into the urban sector. And so I did some jobs as well, looking into urban agriculture right before I started looking at where can I do my master's and focus on the urban sector. But the story also goes that, you know, after I finished my university, I took a year off and I traveled, I backpacked, I traveled from Kenya and I moved all the way down to South Africa and back. I said, okay, before I start seeing the world, I need to see my world, my continent. And then I did a Europe tour and I landed in Berlin and I loved Berlin. And so when I was looking at where can I do this, where can I look into urban management or that area of the urban world, the TU Berlin came up with the urban management course and it was in English. And I was feeling very lazy about learning a new language in order to study in it. And so it was a good choice and I had some money saved up. And that's how I landed in Berlin for my master's.
So urban management, what do you learn there?
It's all about solving problems, as I mentioned before. So at the end of the course, we want to see workable, practice-oriented solutions for city management, you know, to tackle problems such as environmental degradation, uncontrolled urban growth, planning, insecure land tenure of the urban poor, problems in decision-making within the urban environment and urban governance, planning systems, addressing poor housing and working conditions. So all this, so the course was oriented towards learning from others. So about 8-9 people from all different countries, or like 7 different countries. And it was oriented towards how do we work together? How do we compare and get synergies and what works, what doesn't work in different environments? And find actual solutions. We were all people who had already worked. So, you know, it was not like people coming freshly from university, but the course looked for people who had already, you know, put their foothold within the working environment and had that experience. So our ages ranged from the youngest being in their 20s to people in their 40s. It was such an incredible experience for me.
Do you remember your first day on campus at the TU Berlin? What was it like?
Oh, I remember the first day. I also remember my first snow, which was hilarious. I'll give you that anecdote later. But 3 words. I was excited.
Yeah.
I was curious. And I was charged with this. I have always this buzzing energy in me. So if I'm talking, you'll see my hands flying around. And I feel charged. I'm ready to go. Give me what you have, TU Berlin. I'm ready for it. That's how I felt.
Okay, what did you particularly enjoy about your studies?
I just mentioned it just a couple of seconds ago, and the collegiality and the way the course was designed in order to have very practical but also projects that we had to work on, not in as a person, but in groups. So that collegiality and that mixing of expertise and experiences, because we all had our backgrounds were in different things, from engineering to art to public policy, and to bring us in creative groups in order to do collective projects. I loved that so much. I loved working with these people who had already had their experiences within their different countries and learning from them. And I love the fact that that the different areas, you know, from planning to governance, we had a number of professors, not only based in Berlin, but also globally based, coming in and having the courses with us. So that project work was great.
Were there any hurdles in your time as a student that you had to overcome?
Yes, there were. I mean, the main one was funding, because my course is a paid course. It was a paid course, so we had to pay a fee, which is much less than the global standards. That's why I did it. But it was to get myself also. So I did apply for a scholarship while I was there, and I got a scholarship with the KAAD. So getting that funding situation sorted was a challenge. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad to say that I got quite a bit good support from TU Berlin itself in terms of all these applications for scholarships and all. It's November now, and I remember how homesick I got when it came to November. November, December, January are terrible months to be in, especially if somebody's coming from the south. So, I mean, sorry, it's not a hurdle, as I call it. It's not a hurdle, which is occurs in my coursework, but it's a hurdle as a student coming in, a foreign student coming into Germany, especially one coming from the south. And also anecdotally, and I want to mention this because I owe a lot of thanks to you, Berlin, and also my professor, and to my course, the course manager. My passport got stolen. Somebody came in and stole my bag from the classroom where we were. We'd gone out for lunch, and somebody walked in and stole it, and it was a whole huge mess, and you know, with police, because they ended up taking a lot of stuff. But I got such great support from the uni, because I, again, you know, going through the whole process of going to the police and the police asking you in, and being a black woman in dreadlocks, I moved from being a victim to being a perpetrator. Like it was a terrible ordeal, and I wanted to pack up my bags and go. But the professors, and they really wrote a huge, you know, letter condemning, you know, the treatment that I got, and really gave me such support that I said there is so much value in having that level of community within the university and academia system.
Great. Okay, so how did you end up in fundraising after your studies?
By chance. And this is something that most of the fundraisers will tell you, because they have all these skills, but it is always by chance that they end up in fundraising, unless somebody has been exposed to, you know, a fundraising course, or is determined, or is having a career path set out as that. But it was by chance. It was an interest in transparency, accountability, especially in infrastructure management and in conservation and in management of resources. And that's why I went into transparency. But then they were able to have me have a test of different things. So the realism, well, I realize I'm a very good writer, I'm a very good networker. And I fit into a profile of a fundraiser. And fundraising, immediately I stepped into it, was quite exciting. And it is something that is of use, whether one is in conservation, one is in health, one is in education. One needs this. And the skill set of what one gains through this is very, very key for quite a number of other positions.
Is it difficult to get into this industry? You said by chance, so...
It is difficult because there are not so many well-established fundraisers, so those who choose to have this as a career path. We're not so many with the level of experience and expertise, but also because the industry and the way that fundraising or organizations are set up, the cultivation of this as a role and the integration of it within the programmatic work, if one does not integrate it within the programmatic work, it becomes not exciting, not interesting. But if one is able to explore it and go into the program areas and be able to be a spokesperson for the organization, then it carries much more excitement, much more interest, and some more people will stay. So the people who've stayed or who've moved on as career fundraisers have had the opportunity to marry this. Look at the content aspect, but also look at being the spokesperson, but and also spread one's wings a lot further. It is difficult just because people have to start. One almost always has to start from the bottom and build it their way up. You cannot. It's very difficult to segue once you have your 20 years to segue into fundraising unless you have built up this level of expertise upwards.
Let's look at your industry in the future. Is fundraising becoming more and more relevant to get important projects off the ground? And if so, what challenges will the sector face in the next 20 to 30 years?
Fundraising is important because there are quite a number of causes which would never get the time and light of day if it wasn't for charitable giving. So, and one of the key areas of which is increasingly important, I mean, it has been important, but even more so is the area of conservation, but also different other areas from health, now with COVID, as we've seen, to education, to public sector integrity, all that. Some of these causes would never be approached. I have seen the amount of time it took for the Ministry of Health in Germany to put funding into endometriosis research, for instance. But however, there have been a lot of smaller organizations, smaller charitable organizations already working on this, to create awareness to actually get government to put funding into it. So you can imagine how important fundraising is, even in cases where there are, it targets health or it targets, a minority of the population. So it is important. That's the bottom line. The challenges, I mentioned one earlier, was this shifting of priorities. And I mentioned this one when I was looking at, migration. I looked at it within the bilateral arena. But it also affects foundations. So, for instance, now with whenever there are crises in the world, so now we have the Ukraine crisis, or Ukraine war, as it is. We had COVID. There was a lot of repurposing, shifting of funding from other causes to address what is current. And a lot of people who were also giving stopped giving because their businesses were affected, or their personal property or business were affected by or are still being affected by the Ukraine war. And so this is, whenever there are crises in the world, it's a challenge to every other cause that is not dealing with those challenges. So the organizations that were working on COVID and health got a lot more funding. But the problem is that now that COVID has gone down, their funding is going to drop dramatically because now COVID is no longer a priority or ceases to be a priority. The funding ceases to be there. So the level of funding goes up and down according to what the world challenges are at the time. But what we can also see, and this is something where, then fundraisers should think more creatively, is that there are more and more millionaires or multi-billionaires being made despite these challenges. But there are quite a number of people who are making a whole lot of money. And the gap is widening between the rich and the poor, because there's so quite a number of people getting richer. Quite a number of people are getting poorer, but we have a segment of people who are getting absolutely rich, a lot. And all, you know, all these venture capitalists who are throwing money around, people who are involved in cryptocurrency world, which sadly is collapsed. But, you know, all these risk takers who are getting a lot of money. This is a core group of people who people should focus on getting funds from. At least there has to be a way to ensure that they feel that they need to reinvest back into society when they make such money. So there's a lot of, you know, the push for the multi-billionaires of our time, you know, to create the Just Giving program, put their most of their wealth into giving. We've seen that somebody like Gates has been doing this for ages on health. And slowly this is increasing. So maybe the best, you know, in as much as the, you know, we're getting a lot of new millionaires, billionaires, they need to put their money where their mouths are at, you know.
Okay, Flora, thank you for the insights and good luck with the challenges.
Thank you so much. And it was lovely speaking with you. As I said, you know, I will always say great things about the time and the experience I've had at the get-go in Germany from TU and how I've built it up from there. So it's wonderful to do this.
Flora Ikawa-Witte. Ich bewundere Ihre Geduld und Ihre positive Ausstrahlung. Vielleicht ist es euch ähnlich ergangen. Damit, ihr Lieben, sind wir nicht nur am Ende dieser Folge angelangt, sondern auch am Ende unserer Reise durch die abenteuerlichen Gefilde des Alumni-Netzwerks der TU Berlin. Wir hoffen, unsere Gäste haben euch inspiriert. Unser Team jedenfalls hat eine Menge gelernt und für mich persönlich hatte jede Folge ihren eigenen Aha-Moment. Ein letztes Mal erfolgt hier also die Bitte. Wenn euch der Podcast gefallen hat, empfehlt ihn euren Freunden und Liebsten, teilt ihn in den sozialen Netzwerken und lasst uns gerne ein kleines Sternchen und Bewertung zurück. Kontaktiert uns gerne über unsere sozialen Kanäle. Ihr findet uns auf Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn oder Xing. Mehr über die TU Berlin und das Alumni-Programm erfahrt ihr auf den Seiten www.tu.berlin oder www.alumni.tu-berlin.de. Wir bedanken uns bei der Senatsverwaltung für Wirtschaft, Energie und Betriebe in Berlin für ihre Unterstützung bei der Umsetzung dieses Podcasts. Danke auch an alle, die mitgemacht und mit uns ihre Erfahrungen geteilt haben. Danke an das ganze Team hinter diesem Podcast, an Juliane Wilhelm und Bettina Klotz vom Alumni-Team der TU Berlin, an Stefan Enrichkeit für die Postproduktion dieser Podcast-Reihe, an Oliver Baus für das Artwork, der Cover und natürlich an euch. Ich sage Tschüss, eure Regine.